Greetings, warriors, veterans, and America-loving citizens from sea to shining sea. Welcome to Frontlines of Freedom. I'm Colonel Denny Gillum. Hoo-wah! The Frontlines of Freedom team really appreciate you joining us this fine day in America. We are proud Americans. Here's what we have for you this hour. We're going to start by talking with Navy vet Mark Liebman. Then we're going to help World War II vet Al Johnson celebrate his 100th birthday. And of course, we'll conclude with our military history and our self-defense report. So it's a pleasure to welcome to the show my friend, Navy vet Mark Liebman. Mark served a full career. He's now an author. I don't know what else he does, but he stays busy. Welcome aboard, Mark. I said that right, didn't I?
Yes, you did. Thank you very much. Okay. And it's an honor to be with you, Denny.
Tell us about your time in the Navy. When, why, how did you join?
Well, I was a Navy helicopter pilot, and not by choice. I got voluntold to go fly helicopters. And the choice I was given was to quit and not get a set of wings or go fly helicopters. So the rest of that is history. Did a couple tours in Vietnam, flying combat search and rescue, special ops. And then the rest of my career was in flying helicopters. And then when the Navy takes the cockpit away from you, I wound up spending a lot of time as a staff officer on a number of fleet staff and a battle group staff. My career is incredibly successful because they promoted me well beyond my level of competence. And I avoided a tour in the Pentagon.
I salute you on that one. That was also one of my goals, which I achieved, avoiding a tour in the Pentagon. Amen. Okay, what got you started as an author? How does a chopper pilot suddenly decide to use pencil and paper or typewriter or whatever it is you use?
Yeah, I started using a typewriter. So fast forward or go way back, my mother encouraged me to read and to write. And when I was in college and high school, actually, I wrote articles for student newspapers. When I was in college, I was a stringer for two national publications, one on car racing and the other on skiing, because I was a ski racer and I went to a lot of events I reported on in the summertime. Since I was playing around with a race car, I was either there as a spectator or as a participant. And so I got started writing. And then in the Navy, you're always writing stuff. Sometimes it's things you don't like instructions, policy papers. And I started writing for publications, which was relatively easy to get published as a naval officer, because everything you write that has to do with the Navy has to be reviewed, blessed, and before it gets published. So anyway, fast forward towards the end of my career, I read Hunt for Red October and then Red Storm Rising and said, hey, I can write that. And that was like in the 1990s. And I struggled a while, but I kept at it. And then my first book came out in 2012. And since then, I've got 12 out there in three different series, and I'm still writing. So I have one series, it's called the Josh Heyman series. It's about a career of a young naval officer who, oh, by the way, is a helicopter pilot, starts in Vietnam, ends off the coast of Korea. I have another series I call the Derek Elmer Counterterrorism series. It's a bit more contemporary, takes place after the turn of the century. Again, the hero is a Navy helicopter pilot. And then the third series, which has sort of become a labor of love, is an Age of Sail series, which I call the Jaco Jacinto Age of Sail series. And unlike most of the others, which are written about the Royal Navy, this one is about a Continental Navy midshipman and a Royal Navy midshipman who start as mortal enemies. And then one captures the other. They become good friends. And so the series has their careers intertwining as it progresses. And as such, I wound up doing a fair amount of research.
By the way, let me interrupt you to say that series is one of my favorite. So if you want to know where I vote for your book, those are the ones I like best. Go ahead.
Yeah, the Age of Sail. Well, it's a hoot. It's required what my editor says, a PhD in American history during that period. But so I've learned a lot about American history, but they've been relatively successful. The first one, Raid of the Scottish Coast, became an Amazon bestseller. The second one, Carronade, is doing okay. The third one, Death of the Lady, just came out last fall. I haven't done any promotion with it, which is beyond the scope of this conversation. But I'm in the midst of writing the fourth one called Last Battles. And ultimately, I'm under contract for a total of six. It'll probably go to seven, maybe eight. And what's really interesting, my publisher, Penmore Press, says the Age of Sail novels that are on their website, which include the rights to the new Hornblower series books written by another one of my contemporaries, are their best sellers. And so they're incredibly fun to write, but they're also incredibly difficult to write because one has to transport oneself back into the 1770s when there's no electricity, no internet, no roads, no stores, no very few restaurants, and things take weeks to happen. And one communicates long distance via letter.
Yeah, I agree with that. This is Colonel Denny Gillum on Frontlines of Freedom. We're talking with Navy vet Mark Liebman. Mark, let's talk about your most recent book, Death of a Lady. It's part of the series you've already mentioned, but tell us about that book.
Okay, so the first three books start with start early days of the American Revolution. And it literally, because the revolution takes place over 8 years, it's going to take me four books to get through that period. Last Battles is at the last year of the revolution. So the book starts from roughly June 1780 to just after the surrender of Cornwallis in Yorktown. And a point for all your listeners, most people think the American Revolution, at least the fighting, stopped at Yorktown, and that's just not true. It went on for two more years, mostly in the South, in South Carolina, Georgia, and Southern North Carolina. So Death of a Lady is in the heart of what I would refer to as what a Marine officer once said about the Battle of Tarawa: the issue is in doubt. And in 1780, the issue was, in fact, in doubt. Yes, we had won at Saratoga, but Washington's primary goal was to keep the army in being and be a threat, as opposed to actually engaging the British. In fact, he would try only to engage when he knew he could pick the ground on which the battle would be fought, and he would have advantages that the Brits didn't have. So what happens in the war during this book is Cornwallis is now down in Charleston, and he decides to launch a campaign to destroy the army of the Southern Department, which is led by General Nathanael Greene and General Daniel Morgan. They beat Morgan at the Battle of Cowpens, and they beat him pretty badly, but they also took a huge amount of casualties. Later on, Morgan and Greene changed tactics, and they forced Cornwallis to chase them. And they at Guilford Courthouse, they beat the crap out of Bannister Tarleton's legion, what they call the British Legion. And Cornwallis now he's got rid of his baggage train. It's basically troops and supplies, and he's running out of supplies. He runs down, I said runs, he marches down to Wilmington, North Carolina, where there's a small British enclave for reinforcements and resupply. He does. And then he heads north to what's the area, what's now around Washington, D.C., to join up with a general by the name of Phillips and another one by the name of Benedict Arnold. So that leads Cornwallis to join them and ultimately leads him to Yorktown. So that's the context of the war. In terms of what's happening during the book. So okay. In this, you have this young captain, Jaco Jacinto, who is commander of a frigate called Scorpion. It's a unique frigate designed by a gentleman by the name of Hackett, who's based on a real-life shipbuilder, using some of the concepts of Joshua Humphreys, another real-time shipbuilder, and ultimately the designer of the famous frigates Constitution, Constellation, blah, blah, blah. And so Scorpion is fast, it's heavily armed, and it has layered armor in terms of hard oak, pine, soft white pine in the middle, and another layer of hard oak. So when the hard oak on the outside is hit by a cannonball, the pine compresses a little bit, dissipating the energy of the cannonball, which then, voila, drops into the ocean and doesn't penetrate the gun deck.
So if you want to know the rest of that story, guess what you have to do? You got to buy The Death of a Lady. Quickly, how can listeners buy your books?
They're all on Amazon. Some of them are on audiobooks. Some of them are they're all on electronic books. But Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and any bookstore can order them.
Well, there's more to discuss with Mark, and he's going to stay with us. This is Colonel Denny Gillum on Frontlines of Freedom. Troops, it's time to do some knee bends. Go halfway down each time. Do 40. Do this while thinking patriotic thoughts. Mark and I will be right back. Friends, there's not too many things I enjoy more than helping veterans and eating great beef jerky. Now I can do both. My good friends at Tango3.org and America's Best Beef Jerky use the highest quality beef to make the best jerky I've ever tasted. Trust me, I've eaten a lot. But that's not all. They give 100% of the profit to vetted veterans programs, mental health and suicide prevention. Go to americasbestbeefjerky.com and order now. And at checkout, check the Frontlines of Freedom promo code. I'm Colonel Danny Gillum. Thanks for joining us today on Frontlines of Freedom. We're continuing our conversation with Navy vet and author Mark Liebman. Mark, as we've discussed, your research in writing your books brought up some issues that we really need to discuss, because these are things that American citizens, the ones I know, for the most part, aren't thinking about, or aren't thinking about them to the depth that it should be. Our founding fathers struggled with all kinds of issues. Want to start with immigration?
Sure. So one of the things I learned researching the Age of Sail series is it became apparent that many of the issues, in fact, probably all the issues that we struggle with today as a nation, we struggle with in the 1790s and early 1800s and throughout our history. So immigration is one. Taxation, how much do we tax, how much is another. Funding the military, you know, how big, how little, what it should do, another. Leaks from Congress that lead to scandals. So there's all kinds of these issues, and they all happened back then. And so with immigration, to get to your point, is who do we let in and what's the path to citizenship?
Well, it does. And this has been an issue. As a matter of fact, the country that we live in now, we're all immigrants, basically, aren't we?
Yes, we are a nation of immigrants, and immigrants have given this country its rich culture. And you'll find that when you look at the people who have done some of the greatest things in this country, they're first and second generation. But for the most part, we're all immigrants.
Well, I know I am. My mother's was a German Jew who immigrated. My father's mother was an Irish peasant girl who immigrated. And it's nonstop. And there's not only nothing wrong with immigration, there's everything right about it. But we're a nation of law, and we have to do it legally. And we pretty much always have done that, haven't we?
Yes. So if you go back to 1794, when the first Immigration Act was passed, we've gone through a series of acts throughout our history, roughly every three or four generations, where we answer the same question. Who do we let in? What's the path to citizenship? And each time, the context in which the country is living in has changed remarkably since the prior set of laws. So the laws have to be changed, modified, or whatever. But that's one of the things that democracies do, is they can change, because our government should be responsive to the needs of the people.
Yes, sir. And I don't know that we've ever had a situation as disastrous as what we're in right now, because basically the people we have let in the past wanted to be Americans, not just human beings living in our turf. Most of them spoke our language. Most of them brought skills that we needed and could use. They added to the richness, I guess, of America. Is that a fair statement, or am I being overly optimistic here?
I think you're being, you've got some of your facts wrong. I think when you look at the people who came to the United States, they were coming for two things. One, land, because we had it and you couldn't own land in most of Europe, and two, opportunity. And many of them were unskilled. I mean, if you look at the hordes, and I'm using this in a positive sense, that came from Eastern Europe to the United States in the 1780s, 1790s, because the streets were, quote, paved with gold. They lived in horrible conditions in tenements in New York and Boston and Philadelphia and throughout the country. Or you look at the Chinese laborers that were brought in to build the railroad. They came for a purpose, but the secondary purpose is that they will have a better life than they had in the country they came from, and their children and their grandchildren will have even better lives. And that's when you look at the United States, and the reason most people are still want to come here is because we are a land, still pretty much a land of opportunity. You can choose what you want to do. You don't have the government telling you that you have to do this, or you have some noble saying you're indentured to me for the rest of your life, and go back to whatever you're doing and do it. And I'll pay you a subsistence to live. So the United States in many ways is unique, and I'm going to use a quote often misquoted by Tony Blair, but the United States is the only country in the world where people literally are dying to get into, and it's the only country in which it will willingly send its sons and now daughters off to some foreign land to die for somebody else's freedom. And the only thing we often ask is a place to bury our dead.
Yes, sir. This is Colonel Denny Gillum on Frontlines of Freedom. We're talking with Navy vet Mark Liebman. Mark, we got time for one more topic. How about interference by Congress into defense areas?
Sure.
You know, since we're both vets, we've seen that, haven't we?
We've seen it, and we've probably been the victims or the of those kinds of decisions. So you go back to 1794, and when the Navy Act was passed, under John Adams' leadership as the president, there was a goal to reconstitute the Navy. Understand, in 1783, the Continental Navy was disbanded, along with, by the way, the Continental Army. So among other things, there are six large frigates in the bill that were funded and authorized and funded. And that's Constitution, Constellation, United States, President, Congress, and those six frigates. During the next 6 years, instead of taking 2 years to build them, the Congress kept changing the amount of money that was being allocated to fund them. So they would get partially built, and they'd sit for a while. They get partially built, they'd sit for a while. They get built, but they didn't weren't equipped, and or the crews weren't trained. So this went on and on. And as a result, why did this happen? Well, Congress wanted to allocate money to the ports or the cities to have the ships built. And there was a debate on how much money we should spend. Do we really need a Navy? Blah, 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 blah. And we can get into the historical drivers of why we now have a strong Navy. But the first was the French, who wanted to pay back from their loans from the American Revolution. And we said, wait a second, you changed governments. We don't owe you anymore. And then you had the British impressing seamen, and you had the Barbary pirates. And our merchant ships were defenseless. So Jefferson, as much as he hated to do it, was forced to refund and reconstitute the Navy to fight the Barbary pirates, and then he promptly defunded it. And he left Madison with a mess, because by the time Madison took office, the Brits had already impressed about 25,000 American citizens.
Well, that makes it pretty clear that Congress isn't always doing what is best for our country, and part of the reason is because we citizens don't hold them accountable.
That's true.
Mark, we've just got a minute left. You have a final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Yes. The Constitution of the United States is a wonderful document. I strongly suggest that you read it every so often, because you'll find that there are 536 people in Washington, D.C. who lead our nation, many of whom have not read the Constitution recently.
Yes, sir. I could not agree more. Mark, thank you. Thank you for your great books. Thank you for your obvious love of our country. And thank you for your service to our nation in all kinds of ways. I'm proud to call you brother.
Thank you. And I enjoyed doing this. It's a hoot to do these things.
It is. Enjoy it. I'm glad you do. Coming up next on Frontlines of Freedom, we're going to talk with World War II vet Al Johnson about his birthday and his book. Then we're going to open our weekly mailbag. This is Colonel Denny Gillum on Frontlines of Freedom. Troops, it's time for one-arm push-ups. Just do a dozen with each arm, twice. Then take a break, but stay in the area. I'll be right back.
HelpVet.net is here to help all veterans, active military, and families. HelpVet.net is a national help center helping the military community with their everyday needs. Whether you need a realtor, an attorney, discounted services, or information on retirement benefits, financial resources, and much more, our vast network of hand-picked qualified service providers are waiting to help you. With up-to-date military news and resources, you can find answers to all your needs at HelpVet.net. HelpVet.net. Never forget, never forgotten.
Friends, Adam here, Patriot Foods, U.S. only company. Frozen fruits and vegetables straight from our dirt, not overseas. Support the U.S. farmer. When you shop at PatriotFoods.com, we give back to a military family in need. We got to take care of each other, my friends. We have to. So important. 10% off patriotfoods.com, 10% off promo code FREEDOM, and shop today.
Welcome back to Frontlines of Freedom. Troops, I really welcome your comments and questions. Contact me through frontlinesoffreedom.com or comment on Facebook. And it's a real pleasure to welcome to the show World War II Army vet Al Johnson. This past Wednesday, on the 5th of July, Al turned 100. And he's written a book about his amazing service behind enemy lines in World War II. Obviously, it's named Behind Enemy Lines. Okay, everybody yell, happy birthday, Al. Happy birthday, Al. Okay, welcome to the show, Al. Glad you could join us.
Thank you.
Al, how did you end up in the Army? Did you enlist or get drafted?
I got drafted. I figured if they wanted me to work for them, they'd have to draft me.
Okay. And as I remember talking to you, you ended up as a medic, and that isn't what you wanted. Do I remember right?
You remember right. I did not want to be a medic. I wanted to shoot someone, I guess.
But you were trained as a medic, and you were able to use that skill later. Am I right there?
Well, I went to San Antonio, Texas, and took my medical training, and I went as far as a scrub nurse. That was about the highest you could go as a volunteer for a medic. So I took that avenue and went to Denver, Colorado, to a holding camp, waiting to be assigned to a hospital. But in the process, I saw a notice on the bulletin board that the OSS, which was Office of Strategic Services, was looking for volunteers for hazardous duty with a short life expectancy. And I immediately signed up.
When you're young, you do things like that, don't you? You might think about it again. Am I right?
Well, yeah, I didn't mind after I got into a fighting outfit. I didn't mind being a medic or whatever they wanted me to be.
Yes, sir.
I learned to fire all the weaponry that we took with us and the demolitions and et cetera.
Well, I certainly understand that. I graduated from West Point as an infantryman, and right afterwards, we started sending troops to Vietnam, and I volunteered to go. And I had to learn all kinds of things, but I did, and I enjoyed the people I worked with and the missions we were on. That's
right.
Somewhat your story, isn't it?
That's followed up pretty good, pretty closely, yeah.
But you did a lot of your training overseas, right?
Well, we were sent to Washington, D.C. and spent our basic information or basic learning at the Congressional Country Club, which was really a sacrifice.
Yeah.
Considering what some of the men had to live under. We spent 3 months at the Congressional and 3 months at what is now called Camp David, but at that time it was just a big farm. And there we took advanced training in weaponry, and then were sent to North Africa in order to take parachute training.
You know, I remember my first jump out of an airplane. It scared the heck out of me. After that, it was easy. Did your first one scare you?
The first one wasn't bad because I didn't know what was going to happen. But the ones after that, one becomes a little apprehensive.
Yes, sir.
But I was put in as a pusher. That's the last man on the stick.
Yep.
Out of the door. And I pushed everybody ahead of me. And, of course, I followed suit because of the momentum.
Yep. That had to be interesting. And you did it in Africa. What was the next step?
Well, we were assigned groups. I was in a French group, even though I couldn't speak French, but I had the qualifications of a medic, so that made me needed on the priority list.
So how many people were in your training group in the States and in jumping? About how many total?
Well, there were 50 of us in the French group. There were Italians, German, Czechoslovakians, Norwegians, all had their own assignments in their own field. And of course, a prerequisite was to be able to speak the language of the group you were in, but with some exceptions, and one of them was the fact that I was a medic.
Well,
so it didn't have an advantage.
That makes sense. So there were 400 or 500 of you all together total
That's right.
And you went to war. Okay. You got overseas. You got jump trained. What was the next step?
Well, I got to finish the jump training because we were the Norwegians and the French were sent to England, where we took English commando training, which included 6 qualifying jumps out of a balloon.
Oh, I never had to do that.
Well, when we went into France in B-24 Liberators, and they had a ball turret in the bottom, which was removed, and we jumped through that. And in order to practice, we had to jump through a hole in the basket of the balloon.
That has to be pretty tight hole, didn't it? Did you have to squeeze yourself out?
Probably about 60 inches, I think.
Okay.
The English did not have a secondary chute.
Oh.
They had only one parachute. And when some of the gentlemen that were in our group asked the English, why don't you have a reserve chute? The English properly responded that, well, it's not a problem. If the chute doesn't open, just bring it back and we'll give you a new one. It was rather reassuring.
Yes. But obviously something worked because they'd been doing it for their whole military career, right?
That's
okay.
Right.
So that training, then what?
Well, we were assigned the spearhead to the southern invasion of France. That would happen August 14th. So there were 18 of the French group. The various groups were split up into smaller groups.
Okay.
In order to accommodate the particular area that they were jumping into.
Yep.
We landed in Le Blanc, France, which is a small burg made up of a few houses and a few barns and et cetera.
Were they expecting you or did you just show up?
They were expecting us because the Jedburgh team were in about a month ahead of us in order to establish a foothold so we could bring in the larger amount of men.
Okay, so you squeezed out of a hole and jumped in there, huh?
That's right. That was at 1:20 in the morning, pitch black, and we came in at about 500 feet, which is very low, but nonetheless necessary because we had to stay under any radar.
I'll bet you remember that jump.
Well, you couldn't see what you were doing, but you just automatically engaged the knowledge you received from parachuting.
Yes. And you hit the ground and did your thing, right?
We hit the ground and we then made sure we opened up the equipment packages. We had tubes of material that we brought in with us, like demolitions and weaponry for our group and also for the French underground. We armed them with modern riflery, as compared to what they had from leftovers from the World War I.
I believe that. We're about out of time. So anybody who wants to hear the story about what you did behind enemy lines, they're going to have to buy the book. How can they buy the book?
They can buy it through me. The individual purchasing a book can send me a check.
Okay. Who do they send it to?
The book is $12 a piece. And you can send it to Al Johnson, 9481 Pentatech. That's Pentatech Drive, Deland, Michigan, 49464.
And if you don't get that, contact me, Denny, at frontlinesoffreedom.com. I'll contact them for you. Al, thank you. Yeah. Thank you for letting us share your birthday with you. Thank you for sharing your amazing service during World War II. I wish we could have heard all of it. Thank you for your service to our nation. I'm proud to call you friend.
Thank you. You're very kind, very generous.
Hey, I hope we can do this again. I'm Colonel Denny Gillum. Now it's time for our weekly mailbag, and then it's military history time. You've reported for duty to Front Lines of Freedom. Stand tall, troops. Let's do some more push-ups. How about 60 more this time? I want you Ranger ready. then stand at ease.
From ending our nation's endless wars, to making sure veterans get the care they deserve, to addressing our country's out-of-control spending problem, Concerned Veterans for America is taking on the most important issues facing our nation. You can help CVA shape a better future for Americans everywhere. Visit cv4a.org to learn more, see how you can get involved, and join our movement. That's cv4a.org.
Do you have a story inside you yearning to come out? As a self-published author, you are free to creatively distribute your book online or using your own professional connections. White Feather Press will publish your manuscript and set up online distribution, allowing the author to retain all copyright and distribution rights as well as all profits. Check out White Feather Press at publishyourdream.com. White Feather Press, reaffirming faith in God, family, and country.
I'm Colonel Denny Gill, and this is the final formation for this week on the front lines of freedom. Okay, team, it's mailbag time. I welcome comments from you, our listeners. Please do send your thoughts to me at denny@frontlinesoffreedom.com or on Facebook. What's the first one, Skip?
Well, Colonel, Tim, a retired Air Force colonel, wants to know why we don't call our current president the liar that he is, he and his team. They blame all their goofs on Trump.
Tim, you're right. That's exactly what he does.
Sean, a Border Patrol dad, appreciates your coverage of the horrible situation on our border.
Sean, we salute and stand with your child who's trying to protect our border. That's a national disaster that we may never recover from. Thank you for what your boy's doing. And now it's time for military history. What's first, Skip?
Well, Colonel, on 10 July 1777, during the Revolutionary War, Colonel William Barton of the Rhode Island Patriot Militia captured British General Richard Prescott from his bed during the early morning hours. Prescott was the only British general to suffer the ignominy of being captured twice by Patriot forces during our war for independence. Our forces first captured Prescott after Montreal fell to the Patriots in 1775. He was returned to the British in exchange for a Patriot officer, only to face the same plight 2 years later when he awoke to find Barton's men in his garrison. Colonel Barton and his 40 men departed Warwick Neck under cover of darkness on the night of July 9 and proceeded silently across 10 miles of water in Narragansett Bay toward Portsmouth. Evading British warships by staying close to shore, the Patriots were able to completely surprise Prescott's sentinel shortly after midnight on July 10. They took the general, who was the British commander for Rhode Island, and his aide-de-camp directly on board a Patriot vessel without even giving him the opportunity to dress. The humiliated Prescott was held in Providence until the British commander-in-chief exchanged him for captured American Major General Charles Lee. The exchange was particularly appropriate, as General Lee had also been taken into custody in his dressing gown after being surprised in the morning hours at Basking Ridge, New Jersey, having spent the night at White's Tavern enjoying some dubious recreation.
There's a moral here.
Poetic justice, Colonel.
Yes. And on 11 July 1798, President John Adams signed the bill that reestablished the Marine Corps. The Continental Congress had disestablished the service in April 1783 at the end of our revolution. The Marine Corps, however, recognizes its official birthday to be the date that the Second Continental Congress first authorized the establishment of a Corps of Marines on the 10th of November 1775. To add to the confusion of the Corps' actual historical birthday, on the 1st of July, 1797, Congress authorized revenue cutters to carry, in addition to their regular crew, up to 30 Marines. Congress directed the cutters to interdict French privateers operating off our coast during the quasi-war with France and thought that the additional firepower of 30 Marines would be needed by the undermanned and undergunned cutters. It's unknown if any Marines were ever enlisted for the service with the revenue cutters during this time. You just don't know about Marines, do you, Skip?
Well, it's always going to be November 10, 1775 for this Marine, Colonel. On 13 July 1861, during the Civil War, Union General George McClellan distinguished himself by routing Confederates under General Robert Garnett at Corks Ford in Western Virginia. The battle ensured Yankee control of the region, secured the Union's east-west railroad connections, and set in motion the events that would lead to the creation of West Virginia. 2 days before Corks Ford, Union troops under General William Rosecrans flanked a Confederate force at nearby Rich Mountain. The defeat forced Garnett to retreat from his position on Laurel Hill, while part of McClellan's force pursued him across the Cheat River. A pitched battle ensued near Corks Ford, in which Garnett was killed, the first general officer to die in the war. But losses were otherwise light, with only 70 Confederate and 10 Union casualties. The battle at Corks Ford was a significant victory because it cleared the region of Confederates, but it is often overlooked, particularly because it was overshadowed by the Battle of Bull Run, Virginia, which occurred shortly thereafter. However, the success made McClellan a hero, even though his achievements were inflated. 2 weeks later, McClellan became commander of the Army of the Potomac, the primary federal army in the East. Unfortunately for the Union, the small campaign that climaxed at Corks Ford was the zenith of McClellan's military career.
Yeah, he didn't do that well. And on the 12th of July, 1862, during the Civil War, President Abraham Lincoln signed into law a measure calling for the awarding of the U.S. Army Medal of Honor in the name of Congress, quote, to such noncommissioned officers and privates as shall most distinguish themselves by their gallantry in action and other soldier-like qualities during the present insurrection, end quote. The previous December, Lincoln had approved a provision creating a U.S. Navy Medal of Valor, which was the basis for the Army Medal of Honor created by Congress in the July of 1862. The first soldiers to receive what would become our nation's highest military honor were six members of a Union raiding party who in 1862 penetrated deep into Confederate territory to destroy bridges and railroad tracks between Chattanooga, Tennessee and Atlanta, Georgia. In 1863, the Medal of Honor was made a permanent military decoration available to all members, including commissioned officers of our military. It is conferred upon those who have distinguished themselves in actual combat at risk of life beyond the call of duty. Since its creation during the Civil War, almost 3,400 men and one woman have received the Medal of Honor for heroic actions in U.S. military conflict.
And on 11 July 1941, Congress reconfirmed the military status of the Coast Guard, stating, "The Coast Guard shall be a military service and constitute a branch of the land and naval forces of the United States at all times, and shall operate under the Treasury Department in time of peace and operate as part of the Navy, subject to the orders of the Secretary of the Navy in time of war or when the President shall so direct."
And that's military history for today. Now it's time for our self-defense report. Take us there, Skip.
All of us here at Front Lines of Freedom believe strongly in your right to keep and bear arms for protection of yourself and your family. All across the country, violent crime is skyrocketing, and now, more than ever, Americans need to stand up and exercise their Second Amendment rights. Now is the time to get trained and ready to handle this growing threat. But if you're not, please look into it and learn what you can do to legally carry a firearm to protect the ones you love. What's the story this week, Colonel?
Well, at about 4:30 p.m. on Thursday, a man and woman were sitting inside their vehicle in the driveway of their house when a pair of men approached the car. One of the suspects, a 21-year-old male, approached the driver's side door, opened it, and began assaulting the man, accusing him of being a rival gang member. The driver drew a concealed handgun, exited the car during the assault, and opened fire. The shot struck the other suspect, a 19-year-old male, and both subjects fled the scene. Police responded and found the armed citizen, who acknowledged that he had fired a shot at the assailant. The armed citizen was temporarily detained while police obtained witness statements and video recordings of the altercation, which supported his self-defense claim. He was released without charges.
Thanks, Colonel. There's a lot we could talk about with this scenario, but let's focus on the man's decision to use deadly force. There is no mention in this report that the two attackers were using weapons of any kind other than their hands or feet. So why did the police release the armed citizen without charges? I think it helps that other witnesses and video footage corroborated his claim of self-defense. After all, a picture is worth a thousand words, as well as the testimony of other law-abiding citizens. Normally, deadly force isn't authorized unless you are in imminent danger of death or serious bodily injury. Serious bodily injury is loosely defined as any injury resulting in sutures, substantial loss of consciousness, broken bones, or permanent disfigurement. The presence of a weapon makes serious bodily injury more likely. However, it's very possible in certain circumstances to inflict death or serious bodily injury using bare hands alone. So, what exactly were the circumstances in this scenario that legally avail a man with deadly force? I can think of three. First, the man was facing multiple assailants. While it's possible to defend against one assailant with only your bare hands, it's not reasonable to think that one man can defend himself against two or three or even four people. Second, the presence of his wife was also a factor. When loved ones are present, especially women and children, you have their safety to think about as well as your own. In general, our society and its laws more readily avails the use of deadly force to its physically weakest members. That would include the physically disabled, the elderly, children, and also women. The final decision on whether to press charges is up to the district attorney, but it's always a good sign when the police agree that your use of a firearm was reasonable and justified under the law. This man did a great job protecting himself and his loved ones, and Frontlines of Freedom gives him a hearty salute on a job well done.
Well said, Skip. He did a great job. Our movie of the month is Two Strangers Who Met Five Times. You can go to the Frontlines of Freedom website, go to the blog and get the link. You can watch it for free. We will review it at the end of the month, and I'd appreciate getting your comments about it. Send them to me at denny@frontlinesoffreedom.com. Next week on Frontlines of Freedom, we'll talk with William Thomas from Concerned Veterans for America. Then Howard Davis, a Marine vet who fought in the Korean War, will share his story. Our book, Frontlines of Freedom, with 19 authors, has the mission of helping all patriotic Americans step up and help our nation return to our traditional values of serving, not being served, of being in shape physically, mentally, and morally, of being proud of our nation. And it's now available in Spanish. You can purchase that book on frontlinesoffreedom.com or Amazon. Please help us get this call to action book into the hands of all Americans.
Thank you, friends, for joining us for Frontlines of Freedom today and every week on this great station. Please check us out on Facebook and add your comments. And if you missed any part of this show, hey, all our shows are available on demand at frontlinesoffreedom.com. We especially thank our military listeners for serving our country with honor and dignity and for keeping us all safe. God bless you and your families as you serve.
I'm Colonel Danny Gillum. Thank you, listeners all across America, for joining us in the foxholes on the Frontlines of Freedom. Stand tall, be proud Americans, and join me next week for military and veteran information you will not get anywhere else on the Frontlines of Freedom. Dismissed.